One is struck by the omnipresence of the Star-Spangled Banner, even on the T-shirts of the kids who come to watch the sumo wrestlers as the little crowd cheers them on. It's the flag of the American cavalry and westerns. It's the flag of Frank Capra movies. It's the fetish that is there in the frame every time the American president appears. It's the beloved flag, almost a living being, the use of which I understand is subject to rules. Not just rules, but an extremely precise code of flag behavior. Don't get it dirty. Don't copy it. Don't tattoo it onto your body. Never let it fall on the ground. Never hang it upside down. Don't insult it. Don't burn it. It's a little strange, this obsession with the flag. It's incomprehensible for someone who, like me, comes from a country without a flag, where the flag has, so to speak, disappeared. Is this flag obsession a result of September 11th, a response to that trauma whose violence we Europeans persist in underestimating? Or is it something else entirely, an older, more conflicted relationship of America with itself and with its national existence, a difficulty in being a nation, more severe than in the flagless countries of old Europe, that produces this compensatory effect? Maybe American patriotism is more complex, more painful than it seems at first glance.
We have many elements against us, but we have a good element for us, which is the company of Bernard-Henri Lévy here. So a lot of construction going on in the background. The backdrop is quite beautiful for our conversation here. I hope you will hear us. I have a fairly deaf father. That is, he chooses when not to hear me, so my voice is pretty strong. So I hope you will be able to actually understand what I'm saying, at least hear the words, if not understand the meaning. Can you hear me, more or less? Okay. And Bernard has a good voice, too, so at least I think you'll get your money's worth today. It's a great pleasure to be in conversation again with Bernard-Henri Lévy. We've done this a few times before it could be a road show. I usually put on the road again before introducing Bernard-Henri Lévy, who is someone whose passion I deeply admire. He always makes me think of that wonderful phrase of André Gide, who spoke in a political context. He said, si on prend pas parti, le parti vous prend. If you don't take a side, if you don't take a political side, the political side will take you. Bernard has always taken a side. He's always very often sided with people in disarray, has been extremely courageous in his commitments. And for me, he's someone I've known for a very long time, having studied about 100 years ago. I was a student in philosophy, both in Louvain in Belgium and in France at the Sorbonne, at the moment when Les Nouveaux Philosophes, of which he really was one of the most important, were all the rage. Now here to talk today, we're going to talk mainly about his most recent foray into America, which is this book called American Vertigo, which I also heard this morning from Bernard is just about to be made into a film, and maybe he will say a few words about that. He is very well known for a book that he wrote some 30 years ago called Barbarism with a Human Face. And today we are really going to talk as much as possible about American Vertigo. He has taken on, if you will, Trollope's does this work better now? No. Okay. Well, Trollope said, we cannot bring ourselves to believe that a foreigner should in any respect be wiser than ourselves. Now, I would like to ask Bernard-Henri Lévy to comment about this. As you know, he was commissioned by the Atlantic Monthly to go through the country for the better part of a year, I think, wrote five extraordinary pieces that now find themselves in this book. And I wonder, on your trips through America, did you stop in Aspen, or is this the first time?
No, I did stop in Aspen, of course, 1 year ago, maybe. I went in Colorado Springs to visit the Air Force Academy of Colorado Springs, and on my way back, I stopped in Aspen. No, I did that also, of course. I must say about the Atlantic that I will be grateful all my life for the great chance which Colin Murphy, David Bradley, and all the team of the Atlantic gave me two years ago when they made this incredible, which could have turned out to be absurd bet, which was to commission a French writer. Better like this? This was a great bet from their part, a great adventure for me, and a real great moment of my life. I loved America before. I must say that I love America even more, or at least better, after. Better means knowing well or better the dark sides and the good sides, of course, but at the end of the day, loving with knowledge and with intelligence of the thing. So, thanks to Atlantic. I don't know if somebody here is of Atlantic, except the new editor himself. I must tell you that for me, it's a real great experience and great moment of my life.
To get away from this love fest, not everybody in America loves you. As you will remember, there was a front page piece in the New York Times, by Garrison Keillor. I'm sure most of you here read it, where he was quite vicious, one might say. There was an extraordinary picture on the cover, a full-blown picture, which in a way contradicted the article. So on the one hand, you were represented on the front page, but the article was quite vicious. And Slate magazine, a few days after that article, published a piece by Christopher Hitchens, where he called, which was entitled Garrison Keillor, Vulgarian. And he called, I don't know how many of you read it, I highly recommend it. He qualified Garrison Keillor as the Homer of Middle America. And Hitchens particularly attacks Keillor for his francophobic cliches. He sees in Keillor a typical case, and this is the first line from the piece, of a full-blown corn-fed, white-bread American nativist bloviation. I've never known what the word bloviation means. But could you actually respond to the substance of Keillor's attack, and particularly the attack that has come again and again, I think, towards your book, that in many ways many Americans do not recognize themselves in American vertigo and have found some of your ways of dealing with America rather superficial?
My dear Oldengraber, this is the worst question you could ask me. How can I reply to that? Number one, I never reply to by principle.
But you wanted a debate with him.
No, wait a minute. Yes, but a debate is something else, of course. I just answered in the New York Times in the following issue that by temperament, by nature, I like face-to-face oppositions and quarrels. In France we had, and in America, even better, a word which is duel. I like verbal duel. So that is true. I was eager to have a man-to-man confrontation with Keillor. He did not wish to have it. It's okay. But I cannot help him for that. Number one. Number two, I would not say vulgarity. It was not so vulgar. It was a game. It was the rule of the game. You cannot expect, when you take some positions as I take, you cannot expect the other, on the other line, people to be kind and to applaud. I really confronted the sort of America which Garrison Keillor partly embodies. It is absolutely normal that he answers, and he did it with talent. The article was good. Well done. Well done.
So you were pleased by the article?
Well done. It means, you know, I am I am not a man. I don't expect flowers. I fought ideologically, and sometimes not only ideologically, all my life, in all the grounds where I happen to be. So it's absolutely, absolutely normal. The question is not please or not please, like or not like. It is the rule of the game. If you write fine poetry or love novels or philosophy, fundamental philosophy about Spinoza, of course, no polemic. If you write a book about America, where you say that you like this country, that you hate, wait a minute, that you hate anti-Americanism, but that you believe, as many Americans do, that this country is at a turning point of its history, that democracy of America in America is still vibrant but in crisis, you cannot expect everybody applauding again. So this is my no answer, you know.
Well, it was.
And you are not. You are not Garrison Keillor, so...
No, I mean, I am. Nobody is perfect.
Good for you.
This is true.
Good for you.
I'm not the Homer of Middle America. And I'm really sorry that you thought that question was so bad. I myself thought it was quite good. But, you know, that's what makes horse races. You know, to some extent, the criticism has been leveled that you're trying to ingratiate yourself to the Americans. Now, I'll read a paragraph also for the pleasure of reading it, because I think for those of you who have not yet read American Vertigo, it's also stylistically interesting. And so I'll read this passage, where which is, in a way, though you're not a woman, I can concur. You do offer some flowers to America, and you this is kind of a love letter. In some way, one could talk about American Vertigo as a love letter offered to America. And this is what you say. You can refuse to forget either the miserable ghettos of Los Angeles or the mothers of dead soldiers in Iraq, or at the Fort Worth Convention, the bovine stupidity of those who, in the name of the Second Amendment, support the free sale of weapons of war, or, of course, the millions of citizens living below the poverty level and going without health insurance. One detail remains, which hasn't, moreover, escaped the most recent slayers of the Yankee way of life. I'm thinking of the International League of Terrorists, for whom the poverty-stricken ghettos of Los Angeles are evidently not a harrowing preoccupation. I'm thinking of those jihadists about whom you can say enough times that they aim to destroy what is best about the United States: freedom of speech and thought, equality, women's rights, democracy. This basic yet decisive detail remains then. In the sheer fact of being American, or at least expressing yourself like one and wanting to be one, there is a gentleness, a lightness, an element of freedom, and in a word, of civilization, that makes this country one of the few countries in the world where, despite everything, you can still breathe freely today. And I'm thinking particularly as I read this of Saul Bellow's wonderful quotation, where he said that one doesn't love because, but in spite. I'm wondering if you could comment on this.
No, I love. I think you can love both because and in spite. Of course, in spite. No, but to be anti-American as I am does not mean to be blind at all that is going wrong in this country. So, of course, I traveled America during nearly 1 year. I saw long and long, at length, all that Paul Alden Graber quoted. I am not going to come back on that. So, in spite of this, but also because of some of the great aspects of the pattern of citizenship of this country, it's a country where I breathe better than in many places and most of places in the world. Because of what? Because, for example, Mr. Bennett was quoting this fragment of my book about the flag, about the nationalism, the feeling of nation in America. There is one great difference between the way to belong to the nation in America and the way to belong to a nation in France. One little difference which makes a huge gap. In France, to belong to the nation means to have the feeling of sharing the same ground, having the same roots, sharing a long and common memory, having sometimes a common blood, belonging to the same race like racism. This is the way of being a nationalist in France. Roots, soil, blood, and race. In America, to belong to a nation means absolutely the contrary of that. Contrary why? Because people living in this country are white and black. They speak English, but one, two, or three generations before they spoke another language. They were born in all sorts of parts of the world. You know all that. So they cannot be American in the sense, in the meaning of having a common this and that. Being an American means to believe in the community, not of a soil, but of a sky. Not of a blood, but of a law. Not of a grassroots, but of a paper, the Constitution of America. And this way of belonging to a text, this way of recognizing oneself as member of a community because of the common creed, in a credo, this for me is the best definition of freedom, liberty, autonomy in the sense of Immanuel Kant, the German philosopher, which I can conceive. And that's why I feel so stupid. Some of the comments, even yesterday, 4th of July, in the European press, about, for example, the flags, about the appraisal, the affirmation of American nationalism. It's something so different to what we know in Europe.
What were the comments?
Chauvinism, stupid and stubborn patriotism, and so on. I read comments in the French press yesterday on Internet. And this is a complete misunderstanding. So, this is one of the examples which makes that I like this country not only, as Saul Bellow says in your quote, not only in spite. I love this country because the lightness of this way of this nationalism. Milan Kundera, l'insoutenable légèreté de l'être, the unbearable lightness of the being. In America, the very bearable lightness of the being, of the being an American. This is one of the reasons for which you definitely can love this country because. And the worst enemies of America today, enemies to death, who want to really to kill Americans and to destroy the idea of America, what do they hate at the end of the day? As I said in this fragment which Paul quoted, I mean the Ben Ladenist, Al-Qaeda and so on, they don't hate the bad sides of America. They have nothing to care about crimes of America. They don't give a damn for that. They hate exactly what I just said. They hate this way of belonging, this way of being an American, which is the contrary, not only of the way of being a nationalist in Europe, but even more the way of belonging in which they believe. So this is the lovable aspect of this country, one of those lovable aspects. There are many others which make the real material substance of the book. I hope so.
One might ask, though, why you felt yourself compelled to write this book. I mean, did you write it so as to explain America to the Americans, or more to explain the Americans to the Europeans, to Frenchmen in particular?
The idea was not to explain, and especially not to explain to Americans. this is not the purpose. I'm a writer, first of all. I'm not a journalist, maybe unfortunately, but the idea was not to explain. No, the idea was, there were two ideas at the beginning of this book. Number one, you know, there is a famous quote of Stendhal, the French novelist Stendhal, who said that literature is like a mirror, which you bring along the road. A miroir que l'on promène le long de la route. You take it along the road. This book is a mirror of this sort. So not, I don't pretend to explain, of course not, but a mirror, yes. This book is a sort of mirror, good sometimes, less good other times, my mirror of America. And the purpose was to give the mirror to the part of this country who will want to look themselves in it. Some did, some did not. Some liked the image they saw, some did not. Some recognized themselves, some did not recognize. This is the fate of all mirrors. This is the fate of all mirrors. Number two, the idea in Europe now was not to explain again, but I told you before, I'm more a fighter than anything else. The idea was to fight against one of our worst illnesses in Europe, one of our calamities, which is called anti-Americanism. Anti-Americanism, not criticism of America. Criticism of America is a right and even a duty for Americans themselves and for friends of America. But anti-Americanism, which is something else, which consists in transforming America into a metaphysical being, number one. Number two, putting in this metaphysical category all the evils of the world. And number three, to discharge oneself and ourselves in Europe of all our own evils, guiltinesses, insufficiencies by saying it's the fault of America. This is a calamity. For us, for the world, it is a common calamity. It is a widespread virus. It is a plague, which I encountered not only in my country, not only in my continent, in Europe, but all over the world. It's a mot de passe, a password, which you find in Karachi, in Pakistan, which you find in Colombo, Sri Lanka, and which you find, alas, in Paris. And this book had the purpose to bring some weapons, some fires, some arguments in the battle against this plague. Anti-Americanism is a plague, and not a plague for you. You don't care at the end of the day, I hope and I know. Plague for us, for the anti-Americanists. This was the second purpose. So on one side, on the American side, mirror, in which you recognize or not. Garrison Keillor did not recognize himself. What is this image? Ah! Horrible ghost. He saw the ghost of himself in BHL's mirror. Okay, too bad for him. Not for me. The book was a best New York Times bestseller for a few weeks, thanks to him, maybe.
So you are, yeah, that's what I was saying. You're grateful to Garrison Keillor.
This is something else, of course.
Yeah, no, but you are.
Of course, grateful.
So thank you.
Of course.
Thank you, Garrison Keillor.
So you are Garrison Keillor this
time.
No,
just you. Please.
And number two, fighting anti-Americanism. These were the two.
And
words.
How was it received? How did the particularly the French press and readers receive this anti-Americanism? Because it's pretty much ingrained in them to abhor this country.
How was it received? As you can imagine, bad and well, both of course. Bad and well. It was a. I have to say, I'm sorry, but it was not for a few times, but for not for a few weeks. but for many, many weeks, a big bestseller, which proves something, which is that France does not hate America as much as one could think, and that maybe I was saying a few minutes before, maybe we hate America a little less. And there were bad criticism, of course, and good, both of them. Some said that I had sold my soul to the big devil, to the big empire. I commit the crime, for example, in this book, in American Vertigo, in the philosophical conclusions which are in the end of the book, I commit the crime to say, and this is not addressed to you, but is addressed more to my fellow citizens, I committed the crime to say that the very concept of empire, the very idea to make the comparison with the Roman Empire, the Roman paradigm is an absurdity as far as America is concerned. I believe so, and I try to demonstrate, and I think I partly demonstrate it in these pages, that the Roman paradigm is not pertinent to America. That you don't understand anything to the real state of affairs of America. That you don't understand anything in the relationship of America and the rest of the world. That you don't understand anything to the big stupidity which is the war in Iraq. If you apply to all that the concept of empire, America is not the new Roma. This is my thesis. To say this in France today
is not to make many friends.
Might be a real problem, and it was.
But you were also pretty indulgent towards the neoconservatives. Many of them you found to be coming slowly your friends.
No, friends, I would not say.
I'm pushing you.
Yeah, and they did not. If I had the temptation of being their friend, they were not mine. They did not receive well, as you know, the book. But it is true that you say indulgence. I would not say indulgence, but what I am ready to say and to admit is that there is a part of the... Number one, I went to them. I tried to understand who they were and what they thought, really. Not only clichés.
Who in particular?
Bill Kristol, the worst. Bill Kristol, for example, I went to see him. I spent hours with him before making a debate for C-SPAN, which was a good debate of good level between him and me. So Kristol and others. So number one, I went to go. I did not use only cliché. Number two, I refuse the diabolization of the neoconservatives. I refuse the idea of Prince of Darkness and so on and so on. This is true too. If this means being indulgent, I am indulgent. And number three, which is more serious, and this maybe might mean to be indulgent, I do think, and I'm sorry if it shocks some of you, I do think that if I had to choose between the old right, old American right, the old realistic, real politician right, let's say the Kissinger way of being rightist, which is Pinochet, which is the only criterion of American foreign policy is interest, which is I support all sort of dictatorship as long as it is the interest of America. You had to choose between this and a new right, neoconservatives, who make huge mistakes, criminal mistakes, as in Iraq, but who tell us that their enemies are Milosevic, Saddam Hussein, Mullah Omar, that their goal and target is to spread democracy, as we said yesterday, that their philosophical belief is that relativism has to be hated and so on. Of course, I choose the second one. I say also in the book that I prefer not to choose as I say, my American heroes or my American friends are not their heroes and are not them. My American heroes are John F. Kennedy. My friends are Barack Obama or Jim Harrison and so on, you know, all that. So the best is not to choose. But if I had to choose pistol of the brain between the archaeo-conservatives and the neoconservative, I just say, yes, that all is not for the worst. That all has not to be hated in the position of the neoconservative. And even in the Iraqi affair, I believe that it is a huge mistake for precise reasons. But I do believe, too, that the goal to overthrow Saddam Hussein and to settle democracy instead of him is not at all a bad goal, is not something which has to be despised. For me, I was since the first day against this war for three reasons. Number one, a war is just in three conditions. Number one, multilateralism. Number two, to have some allies on the ground. Number three, to have a minimum of knowledge of the situation in which you pretend to intervene. The neoconservatives had neither of these three conditions. They did not know anything about Iraq. They had no ally. Shalabi was not Massoud. Shalabi was not the Northern Alliance. And instead of multilateralism, they gave the worst example possible, which was a unilateralist war, giving the worst example to anybody, to Putin tomorrow and so on. So that's the reason why this war seems to me to be the worst possible example given by American democracy. But the idea to spread democracy, the idea to kick down a dictator, the idea that Iraqi people too also deserves democracy, all that is not méprisable, is not despisable.
Something despicable.
Despicable. To despise. So if this means indulgent, okay.
It might mean that. But if you had a gun again to your temple here, and we spoke a little bit about the former American left and the current American left, how would you comment on the current American left in America? The one you came into contact with. Because, you know, you met the neoconservatives, but you also had many, many meetings with people as diverse as Soros and Sharon Stone.
This is a spectrum of the American left, on your point of view?
No.
No, I met a lot of people, of course, on this side. People of the unions, people of the Democratic Party, people of the left, if it can be named like this, of the Democratic Party, and so on. My impression, the mirror was not so flatterish on this side. This is true. I did not find the American left in such a good shape. Number one, when I met the people of the Democratic Party, when I tried to interrogate them, to ask them about ideas, most of the time they answered me about, I asked about ideas, they replied about money. They replied about money. The very strange obsession which I found was that I really believe that their belief, their conviction is that the right generally wins because she has the money. That they have the ideas and that the right has the money and that they will win again when they will have the money again. I think it's a big mistake. Number one, the right has some ideas. Previous point, the neoconservatives have some ideas. You can hate them or not, but they have some ideas. They have read, I remember Paul Wolfowitz quoting Leo Strauss, quoting Thucydides and Aristotle. You cannot say that he has no ideas. And on the other side, true. I met in Washington people, I name them. I quote them in the book, high-ranking democratic responsibles telling me about fundraising, and when I asked them, but fundraising for what? In order to defend which ideas? Too often they told me fundraising in order to do again some fundraising.
You had
not always, some of them.
You had difficult experiences or interesting experiences with MoveOn.org. I wonder if you could say a few words about
MoveOn.org. Yeah, I met them in Berkeley, and again I was. Again, I was surprised. Of course, they are, in a way, on my point of view, the cream of the cream. If there is a new stream, a new current in the American progressive camp, this is one of the places from which it comes. The campaign in order to enlist some new voters, the campaign in order to oppose to the Iraqi war are some models of democratic behavior. This is clear. But the other thing which impressed me and disappointed me and depressed me, was on a very precise point, and not at any point, a very important one, because it is the act of baptism of MoveOn.org, their extraordinary commitment with what I would call, very quickly, Puritanism. As you know, MoveOn.org was born at the moment of the Lewinsky affair, when Bill Clinton was, when there was this project of impeaching, you know all this story. MoveOn was born there, and the slogan was, and censor the president and move on to more pressing issues. When I asked to the people of Move On with whom I was, but move on to new problems, burning problems, I understand. But why censor the president? Why? Did you really think at this time? Do you really think today that Bill Clinton had to be censored? And why not impeached? My surprise was to discover that, of course they thought. Of course they shared with their worst adversaries, with those who declared, waged the war against the Democratic president, they shared this prejudice. They shared this idea that, the private life of a president, the inappropriate behavior of a president, was a public affair, was a fault, and was a crime. And we discussed about all that at length, of course, from this little point, the point of departure of MoveOn, censor, and my surprise, my discovery was that they were really invested, they were really inhabited by this political Puritanism which they share with the other side, the judge star, and so on and so on.
Since there's so very few foreigners to this wonderful conference here at Aspen, I thought instead of staying on with the book and talking about the various journeys you took, and some of them are really extraordinary to read about, your time in Guantanamo, for instance, visiting some of the mega churches, I thought we would move perhaps to first to France and then to Israel and then open it up to the public. Very quickly to France. Yesterday I heard in two or three of the panels mention of the students' riots in April or the student rebellion in April. And from all the information I have and from my trips to France, it just didn't seem at all that what was happening on the streets of Paris was a riot in the least. And having been a 68ard yourself, somebody in 1968 who took part in students' riots, I wonder if you could comment on the state of the young people in France today and what they were asking from de Villepin's measures.
True, yes. I think that American press sometimes, not always, but mixes two different things. riots of last year in the suburbs, ethnic riots, riots of poverty, not so different of what you Americans knew 15 years ago in Los Angeles. This is one thing. And then the demonstration of students a few weeks ago, which were not riots at all, which were a movement of youth against the government and so on. So there is a mixture of the two, a mélange, a confusion between the two. And there is also the false idea in American press that Paris is burning. There is this image sometimes, which is not so true. Paris is not burning, I can tell you. I can assure you. Same about French anti-Semitism. There is a new anti-Semitism in France. There is a progress of anti-Semitism in France, as there is in the rest of the world and also in America, maybe, but not to the extent of a new Kristallnacht, not to the extent of Paris being impossible to inhabit and to live in for a Jew. This is not true. This is often undersaid. This is often said even in the American press, but it is not the reality. There is a tide of anti-Semitism, of a different sort, by the way, of what was known in the past, but it is not a mass movement overwhelmingly depressing. This about the riots and about the youth. The youth, the demonstration of last spring. You have three ways of seeing them. Number one,
always three ways. It's interesting.
It depends.
Mostly three.
Reality is dialectic. It is not to the old pupil of Hegel you are, my dear, that I always learn that. First way, to believe that it is a sort of subversive or idealistic movement, as my generation knew in the 60s, proposing a new ideal, a new form of society, and so on and so on. This was true for some of them, but very few. Not comparable, not possible to compare to what happened in the 60s. This dimension of the phenomenon, idealistic, utopian, new values, opposition to a certain sort of society in the name of another one, was present in some of the mind, but few. Number two, this was often quoted in the conservative press in America, because there was one poll saying it. It is true. The fact that the French youth has one ideal, which is to become state servant, functionary. I had a debate with Bill O'Reilly about that.
So they want to be old as early
yes,
on.
Yes, French youth dreaming to become old as soon as possible.
There's that line of Thucydides where he says that some people are born with gray hair.
Exactly. Yeah. It is true also for a part of the whole story of the whole movement. There was a second third, which was in this case, but not all of them again. And what I would say is that the third part of it, and the third dimension of the movement, was a sort of huge Princeton, Harvard, Cambridge, whatever, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, in the street. A sort of learning in the ground, a sort of civic education to politics, in the tide, in the movement. This was the third meaning of this story. And in France, things happen often like this. We have a school in France which is called ENA, École Nationale National School of Administration, which is supposed to be the biggest school, the best school to breed, to shape the leaders of the state. But my opinion is that if you look at the 40 last years, the best ENA, the best national schools able to build some leaders is the street. This is a French tradition. The street is the best ENA. The best
the
leaders.
The street.
The avenues. The demonstrations.
The boulevard.
The boulevard. The boulevard Saint-Germain. On my windows. This is the best ENA in France. This is a French tradition of Gavroche, Barricade, 79, 48, La Commune de Paris, and so on. And you cannot see this event of last spring if you elect one of these three aspects. The three of them were true. Idealistic movement, like in the 60s, gray hair babies, like in Thucydides and Bill O'Reilly.
Soldier.
I am not surprised, and nobody can be surprised. This is a tradition of Israel. The love of the life, the love of their people, la pureté des armes, purity of weapons, as they say in Tzahal, the kidnapping of soldiers, of one soldier, one hair of the head of one Israeli soldier, as you know, and Hamas should know, is something which cannot just be like this. It provokes a strong reaction. Hamas knew that. The world knows that. The Arab world knows that. It's not a surprise. It's not a surprise. Number two, I know that there is a current of opinion in America and in Europe saying that you have to discuss with Hamas. And by the way, I'm sure that Israel will finish to discuss with Hamas, I suppose, as they finish to discuss with OLP and so on and so on. But one cannot forget and one cannot just be blind at the fact that Hamas, the government of Hamas, is not an ordinary government. Of course it was democratically elected, this is true. But it is not an ordinary government. A government of people who believe in the protocol of the eldest of Zion. A government which believes that one state has to be erased of the surface of the earth. A government which practices a sort of rabid, without any nuance, anti-Semitism, is not just one among many democratically elected governments. Except if you believe that except if you believe in this relativism in which I said that we should not believe before, you have to admit that there is a European fascism, which we knew in France, which we knew in Germany. There is a European fascism. There is an American fascism. You have still some specimen of that in Idaho and in other places of America. You have an American fascism, but you have also an Arab fascism. American fascism is not an oxymoron. Is not a category in the world, is not a contradiction in the world. And Hamas is a fascist party. This is obvious. All the characteristics are there. All the red signals are enlightened when you look at the Hamas. So the Palestinian people, they elected him, of course, but they could not expect the democracies of the world, and especially the democracy of Israel, to react as in a party of bridge or cards, peaceful and civilized. It's a real problem to put in power a self-proclaimed, a self-claimed fascist party is not an ordinary act. Now, if you ask me, if I think that the reaction of the American Israeli army has a good proportion, or if it is disproportionate,
then I would have some doubts, of course. As often, with the Israeli reactions, as often, there might be, and there is maybe, some lack of political sense. And therefore, there might be sort of disproportion.
And that lack of proportion brings about more violence, which could
No, violence is before. No. I refuse the idea of the... I criticize, of course, it's like anti-Americanism. To be against anti-American does not mean that you don't make critics against American government. Same for Israel. I believe that anti-Zionism is a new word for anti-Semitism, but it does not mean that the Israeli government is out of critics. You must do some critics when it deserves critics. Generally, by the way, I do it in Israel itself. I prefer that. But okay, I admit that some critics may be done and must be done. But I refuse the idea of the spiral of violence. There is not a spiral of violence. It is not true. The first violence is the violence of those Hamas being a part of them who really believe in the depth of their belief, in the depth of their mind, in the depth of their heart, who really believe that Israel as itself is a scar, is a foreign body in this part of the world. This is the first violence. There is no spiral of violence. This is not true. And this violence is so strong. I know this part of the world. I know Israel, but I know Palestine too. I was, not so long ago, I spoke with Palestinian progressive militants in Birzeit, University of Birzeit in Ramallah. And this is a real problem. The question to know if Israel had a right to be there or not. And so many of them do believe that Israel has no right to be there. This is a real problem. So the most clever, of course, the most intelligent, have their belief on one side, and on the other side, they know that they have to do with, and they have to admit, and they're okay. But you have so many like Hamas who are not at this point.
I think I would like to, on this very joyful note, open this up for discussion, conversation. Sean, do you want to ask? Should I give a mic? Might be good for you to come up.
I have a very short comment and a very short question. It's wonderful to finally find someone who's not only whose politics, but whose philosophy of politics speaks so much to my own. It's a privilege. I agree with 99.9% of what you said, except for one tiny part which breaks my heart. Not for you, but for my country. Because I think that the pestilence you talked about, the plague of anti-Americanism, it's in America too. That the American left has this problem. Maybe not Mouvan, who have Puritan problems, but it's a kind of soixante huitardisme that never evolved. You know, that stayed stuck. And I see a lot of it in New York. I see it all over the intelligentsia, especially around the academy. So it breaks my heart to say that what you're arguing about is an argument that we have to have here too. That's the comment. The question is, what is there about Barack Obama that separates him, that distinguishes him from other Democrats, other liberals? Why do you like him so much?
About the first point, I agree. Of course, anti-Americanism is not a European speciality, and of course you have a specimen in America. This is true. With one nuance. For me, to think, penser contre soi, to think against oneself, as Montaigne, Michel de Montaigne said, can be and is in a way the honor of a soul, you know, penser contre soi, to think against your own interest, to think against your own comfort, to think against your own family sometimes, is, might be, for a Frenchman, for an American man, for whoever. It is part of the plague, of course, but it is also a sort of honor. It is a proof of the liberty of the spirit. It is a proof of the liberty of the spirit. And I would say that you don't have the cream without the butter. You have not the democracy without that. To be a real democracy means to have also that. In Israel, it is so evident. It is so heartbreaking for me when I am in Israel to see so many intellectuals who are much more severe against their own government and country than the worst anti-Zionists. But I must say also, I have two reactions. First reaction, heartbreaking. Second reaction, okay, this is the very sign of the healthiness of the Israeli democracy. I would say the same for America and same for my country, for France. You have in France, I remember I was a child, but during the Algerian War and so many other moments, some Frenchmen engaging themselves against the not only the majority, but nearly the unanimity of their country. It is a proof of health. It must not be completely mixed with the anti-Americanism of those who want the death of America. About Barack Obama, the specificity, I try to say it in the chapter of the book devoted to him. If I remember well, I say that it is, there is something new in what he says and in his behavior compared to the other, the previous African Americans of the last years. And the new thing is that il n'est pas dans la revendication. He is not in the revendication. He is not in the accusation. He is not in the guiltiness. He is an African-American of the period after, coming after the inculpation, after the war, the civil war. There was a sort of civil war which lasted so many decades till recently. He comes after that. He plays not on accusation, but on seduction. Il joue, non pas, I don't know the name in English in translation. Il ne joue pas sur l'accusation, mais sur la séduction. Okay. As often, if you want to translate, you have just to make yarn at the end, and it works. This is a new point. This is a new point. And a real love of this country, too. A real love. I remember his speech at the Democratic Convention. I happened to be there. It was not my goal, but my Atlantic journey coincided with the electoral moment. His way of saying there is of course a blue and a red America, there is of course, but there is also a United States of America. It was a good quote. It was a good quote. So I would not say that it is my, you have noticed that when I said I distinguished between my heroes who are dead and my friends who are alive. Barack Obama is not my hero. But I believe that if I was an American, he would be my friend.
I'm sorry I can't throw some French into it. I embarrass myself. Two questions. Other than Iraq, is the anti-Americanism based on Bush greatly, or what are some of the other themes? And second, I'm glad that you feel that anti-Semitism has not reached the Kristallnacht stage. By then, I think we'd be in terrible trouble. But the new, and I'm glad that you do say that the new anti-Semitism is an anti-Zionism, and it is, it seems to me, in England and France, predominantly on the left, in the left intellectuals. I'd like you to comment on that.
About anti-Americanism being fed or not by Bush, I don't think so. And I don't think, I am not pro-Bush at all, you know that, I suppose, and if you had just a glance at my book and at the chapter devoted to Bush and called The Revenge of the Little Man, you know that I'm not pro-Bush at all. But I do believe, and I pray you to take that seriously, the most serious anti-Americanist in the world, they hate America not for the bad which America does, but for the good which America is. This is a first theorem. Anti-Americanism hates the best side of America, not the worst. You will never find one quote of Bin Laden or any of his lieutenants speaking about poverty, speaking about racial issue in America, speaking about Las Vegas. They don't care about that. They speak about pretty women having skirts too short, pretty faces being naked, freedom of speech, newspaper being, and so on. So this is le premier theorem, the first axiom. Anti-Americanism targets not the bad side but the good side. So it means, of course, Bush does not help. This is sure. But it means that Bush is not the main culprit. About anti-Semitism in Europe and also in America. Left or right, I don't know if it can be expressed like this. What I would say more precisely, if you allow me, is that we face a new sort, a new generation of the phenomenon. Anti-Semitism is like a virus which has some mutation, you know, the mutation of the virus. You had the time of the anti-Semitism being mainly Christian, the Jews being accused of having killed the Christ. You had a period when anti-Semitism was mainly anti-Christian. The time when Jews were accused of having invented the Christ. Anti-Semitism of the Enlightenment of the 18th century. The atheistic anti-Semitism, which was a strong tendency in Europe. Jews being guilty of the reverse. Not to have killed, but to have produced. You had an anti-Semitism which mainstream was racism. Jews being guilty not of having killed, not having invented Christ, but guilty of being a specific race, being a sort of infection, infecting the other races. End of the 19th century, time of the social Darwinism, beginning of the new biology, and so on. The racist anti-Semitism, which was again another sort. You had again a fourth sort of it, which was, I would say, leftist in this case, the anti-capitalistic anti-Semitism. The moment of the Dreyfus affair in France. The moment where Jews were guilty of controlling the international finance, plutocracy, and so on. You have some periods, okay? You could make a very precise periodization of the story. Today, we have a new period when
anti-Semitism, is it your phone or mine? Yours, I think. Mine is switched off. Today you have a new form of anti-Semitism which make the Jews phantasmatically guilty of a new crime. I would say that the three legs anti-Semitism today walks and goes on three different legs. Three different legs. Again, number one, anti-Zionism. Jews being guilty of having produced and being friend with the worst state in the world, being himself guilty of oppressing the best people in the world, Israel versus Palestinians. First leg, anti-Zionism. Second leg of the new anti-Semitism, negationism. Negationism, revisionism, which is negationism of the Shoah, which is more precisely the idea which you find in all the new anti-Semitism of today, the idea according to which Jews are exaggerating or even inventing completely the myth of their own suffering in order to justify Israel, in order to increase the legitimacy of their oppression of the poor Palestinian people. Negationism coming in support of anti-Zionism. And number three, the third leg of the new phenomenon, which I would call the word has to be still to be produced, but let's say provisionally, competition of victims. Competition of victims. The new anti-Semitism says, please, let's stop with the Jews. There are some other sufferings, other victims today, and the more you speak of these, the less you care of those. As you know, I'm sure it is stupid, of course. The suffering is not a market. We are not some shareholders of the big market of suffering. Moreover, the human heart is great enough to bear different concerns and mournings and sorrows. Number three, I would even say, and this is one of my deepest beliefs, that the more you are concerned with the Jewish past suffering, Shoah, the more you are able to be aware of, to see the first signs of the sufferings of today. That's why, by the way, it is generally, at least in Europe, America, I don't know, Jewish intellectuals who were the first to protest and to feel the first advanced signals of the genocide in Rwanda, of the war crimes in Bosnia, and so on and so on. So this argument of competition of victims is just bullshit, just absurd, just pitiful, but it is a big one. The new anti-Semites of today say that. They say, shut up the Jews, let's express the other sufferings. New anti-Semitism works on the three. It is no longer Catholic. It has no longer to do with racism. Nobody believes today, seriously, or few, that Jews have a special nose and a special mentality. This is completely minoritary, but they believe that Israel is a fascist state, that Shoah is a myth invented in order to justify Israel, and that there is a market of the suffering and the competition of the victims. These are the three founding stones of the new delirium.
In the spirit of this afternoon, I see that there's, for some good reason, there are three people who still want to ask questions. And so I am going to call on those three people, you and you there, and I'm going to ask you to ask very brief questions in my experience in the after about 25 seconds. And I'm going to ask something quite impossible, but not to give a short answer.
Yeah.
C'est là. Bon, I was in Cuba recently and was amazed that the Cuban people said, we love America. And I said, how can you love America? Because we've had an embargo against you for 50 years. And they said, because we distinguish between the people and the administration. You've partly answered this question. My question is, once there's a new administration and things are different, do you think the French will change the way they feel about America, or will that not happen until the ladies lower their skirts?
Mr. Holdengraber gave the order of the three questions being asked first. I obey.
Two questions about your journey around America. Number one, how did you choose your itinerary? And number two, when the Atlantic Monthly sponsored you, were there any parameters that were set?
Any what?
Parameters, department.
I'm from Egypt. I'm a reporter from Egypt, and I just had a question for you concerning the situation in Palestine and whether you think that had the Israeli government given some support to Mr. Abbas when he first became president in January 2005, that could have changed the situation a little bit in terms of Hamas getting elected. What I mean is that in the Arab world, there is an entire camp which supports peace with Israel. I mean, whether governments or seculars or leftists, for example, but don't you think that this camp is being weakened by the policies of the Israeli government? And my second question is concerning a repeated request for us Arabs to recognize the right of Israel to exist. I mean, personally, I was born in 67, so I recognize Israel's existence, but the right to exist is a very ideological matter. I mean, as far as I've studied Zionism is the belief in the right of the Jews to have their state in Israel. So I don't know if you would like to ask for an Arab Zionist party or something like that, which is a very difficult matter. Thank you, sir.
I'm sorry, I did not... Can you translate me, Paul?
Arab Zionist party. If you... Si tu veux un parti arabe et sioniste qui s'unisse... C'est idéologique.
You know, you have 20% of Israeli today. 20% of Israeli population are Arabs. They live in Israel. They are citizens of Israel. And contrary to what is often said, they have, except the military service, all the rights of citizenship in Israel. This is what I say. Except the fact that they don't serve, they have all the other rights. So you can be a good Israeli citizen and being an Arab. About Palestine and Palestinian Zionism, I do believe since you were born in 67, the first article I ever wrote in my life, the first article I ever published, was in 68. In a French magazine, this article was called Zionisms, with S at the end, in Palestine. And what I said in this article is that I supported the idea of a Palestinian diaspora, people, and so on, feeling a sort of Zionism toward a Palestinian state. I believe in that. I believe in a two-state solution. I believe that half of this earth has to belong to Palestinian people. I do believe that. As many Israeli, as a majority of Israeli believe. As Mr.